everyone. I'm Claire Wright.
And I'm Eve Rees.
And we are historians. And if this introduction sounds to you like a confession or an act of sharing our addictions, well, you're right. We are here to tell you about our addiction to the archives.
So welcome to Season 5 of our podcast, Archive Fever, where each episode we'll be conducting intimate conversations with writers, artists, curators, fellow historians and other victims of the research bug.
We talk to these archive addicts about what kind of archives they use, how often they use them, when they got their first hit, and what is their funniest, saddest, most frustrating and most illuminating experience in the archives.
And, as always, we'll be asking the question, what madness is this?
Today, Eve and I are joined in the Sydney studios on Gadigal land by the very wonderful multidisciplinary writer, performance artist and critic Fiona Kelly McGregor. Fiona has published 7 books, including Indelible Ink, which won the Age Book of the Year and was shortlisted for several other awards, Strange Museums, the memoir of a performance art tour through Poland, the short story collection Suck My Toes, which won the Steel Rudd Award, and the underground classic Chemical Palace. She writes for The Monthly, The Saturday Paper, Overland, Runway and Running Dog. And Fiona is known for her extensive repertoire of performance art with a focus on the body, duration and endurance. And she's an organiser in Sydney's alternative queer culture. Fiona's latest novel is Iris, which was published in 2022, and it's a complete cracker. Eve and I emailed each other immediately after reading this book to say, AF, AF! Iris is based on the life of petty criminal and busker Iris Webber. It's set in 1932 to 1937. Iris has been described as epic and picaresque, a star-crossed love story, a teeming social portrait of schemers, gamblers, good-time girls, gangsters, and sly groggers. It's been longlisted for the Stella Prize, the Book People Award, the Miles Franklin Award, the ALS Gold Medal, and shortlisted for the New South Wales Premier's Award. And some of these awards have not been decided by the time of this interview today, so we'll update the website when the episode drops later in the year. Fiona, congratulations on the success of Iris, and welcome to Archive Fever.
Thanks so much for having me.
Now, we'll get back to Iris and why Eve and I are both so besotted by it. But first, we'll start by asking the question we ask all our guests here at Archives Anonymous. When did you first get bitten by the research bug?
In 1993, I had finished my first book and was finishing my second. I got into the habit from this time of going off to the State Library just to drift net fish. And I came across the document, I don't know what it's called, but it's like the sort of founding document of the English when they came to Australia in 1788, which actually spells out that in their law, sovereignty was recognised. And so in a way, it's one of the things that shows that they broke their own law in invading Australia and denying sovereignty to the First Nations people. And it blew my mind because, of course, having been educated in the 70s and 80s, I had not been taught anything. And Mabo had happened and I had already discovered Henry Reynolds. And so I was avidly educating myself. And finding this primary source was kind of euphoric, really. It was the proof, yeah.
And so what did it feel like for you, I'm thinking in a really embodied sense, to feel that tug of the archive, that archival find that drew you in?
It makes time collapse and it makes you feel like you're in the moment that is history, but it also makes it apparent that history really is in the present. The paper was confirmation of the political path I was already on because I'd done a lot of activism in the 80s across a range of things, and including First Nations issues. And like I said, I was reading Henry Reynolds and Mabo had happened. And so it was just confirmation of what I knew.
I love that expression you just used, drift netting through the archive. Can you explore that metaphor a little bit more for us?
Drift net fishing is probably what I did for Iris. I had that habit of going into the library and I did that in between a few books, and it's probably a really inefficient way to research a book, but it does open you up to lots of other things that you didn't even know you were interested in, that ultimately, like in terms of Iris, do serve the book because they're often the little everyday textural things that are really important to a life. I started to look at the material for Iris 20 years ago, and I was at the same time trying to figure out the history of my house. It's 130 to 40 years old. So I pulled the Sands directory off the shelf at the Mitchell Library, and I found the first people who lived there. Also in those days, the police gazettes were kept in the library, so they were physical books that I also pulled off the shelf. And later on, my research became more digital.
Yeah, it's just reminding me, I'm thinking back to my undergraduate years at university and the joy that I experienced in actually just spending hours in the basement of the Baillieu Library where they used to keep the journals. Do you remember? And actually pulling things off the shelves and sitting there on the floor cross-legged and opening them. And how our students today, they can't do that because everything's digital and you can't drift net in the same kind of way. Yeah, I'm feeling quite nostalgic.
I know. This is making me realise this is how I developed my whole research career, because I found my honours research topic through picking up a book from the shelf, an old copy of Mianjin, which had a short article about an artist, Mary Cecil Allen, that I ended up writing about. And then she inspired my PhD and the research I'm still doing today. So
yeah,
it's powerful stuff.
Yeah. University libraries don't even have books, let alone journal articles and other hard copy in the libraries anymore. It's all just open tables.
And there's so much stuff that you can't find digitally. Yeah, definitely.
Okay, now I'm feeling nostalgic and also sad. Your 2008 travel memoir, Strange Museums, followed your journey across Poland. Fiona, why Poland?
Because I was in a relationship with Ania Wojak for 7 years, and that's the person with whom I started to do performance art. And Anya's heritage is Polish, and we couldn't get much work here. And so although Anya was born here, they had contacts in Poland, and we set up a tour of Poland and off we went. And it was quite amazing, and we ended up staying longer than expected.
And the title of that book, now our regular listeners know that we are very captivated by museology and museums and the strange things that go on in museums here at Archive Fever. Are Poland's museums particularly strange?
Well, then they were. They were really elliptical about a lot of the passage of immigration of a lot of people, particularly about Jews and Gypsies. That's one museum which I think is mentioned in that book. And very poorly funded. The museum in Auschwitz is in a constant state of being upgraded, and the funding depends on money from all over the world, actually any country that was implicated in the Holocaust. And so that was quite amazing. I spent a day there. That kind of changes your life. It's face to face with atrocity. Other ones, yeah, I think it would have changed in the last 15 years, probably. There's a big museum to European Jewry in Warszawa, which was built after I left. And I'd be curious to have a look at that, actually.
Let's get to Iris. How and when did you first encounter the protagonist, Iris Weber?
In an exhibition which was about what we then call gay and lesbian history in New South Wales Parliament House in, I think, 2002. And I'd just finished Chemical Palace, and what I saw was the photograph which is on the cover of the book, which is the only photo that we have of Iris Weber, and I was quite transfixed, and it was a really large blown up photo, and she was described as a lesbian gangster who'd shot some gangsters in rivalry over their gangster moles, and of course I was titillated.
Who wouldn't be?
Yeah. And off I went, because it was the end of a book. And so I was due to go off and driftnet fish, and there I had this great subject to look at. And I went to the Mitchell Library, first of all. Some of the state archives at that time might have been still in the rocks. And I would like to actually pay homage to Fabian Loschiavo, because he died recently.
Oh, did he? I interviewed him for Shooting the Past for the Radio National series that I did a few years back. He was a beautiful man.
He was a beautiful man, a really important archivist. And he's one of the people I thank in the book. And he's one of the first people I went to with the questions about how do I do this? Where do I go? Where will I find this material? Quite quickly, within a month or two, I had the most important information about her, including holding the bullets from her gun that were in the evidence box at State Archives out at St. Mary's. First of all, that plaque in the museum was just sensationalist rubbish, and she was none of those things. Queer is the word we need to use for someone because it allows us to not impose 21st century. That's what she was. She had two husbands. She actually married a second time after the events of the book. After I was holding those bullets, I knew I had to write about this person, but I didn't know how because I certainly wasn't a historical novelist. And that was 20 years ago. And so I just kind of filed away this information. And then I went off and did, I think I was probably doing quite a lot of performance and activism and curation at that time. And I was starting to write essays and taking my art criticism more seriously. And then I started Indelible Ink and, you know, 20 years went by, basically. I did go back. I did a doctoral thesis in this material. And so I enrolled at UTS and I got a stipend for 3 years and it enabled me to conduct all of the research in a structured, disciplined way.
And did you find that having that framework helped you? I mean, that's an interesting contrast between the drift netting and then having a much more bureaucratic framework and institutional as well. You don't strike me as having come to your research from an institutional background and now suddenly you're funneled through an institutional framework.
Yeah, unfortunately, though, because you're doing a doctoral thesis, they treat you like an adult and let you do it on your own. So I kept drift net fishing. It took years and years and years. It took a lot longer than probably if I'd been a trained historian like you two. I was very undisciplined and I just got way more material than I probably needed.
Oh, no, that just makes you a regular historian.
Really?
People often think historians are trained in a more systematic way than we actually are. There's a lot of learning on the job that goes on.
Yeah, completely, and a lot of over-researching. I mean, I think every project is probably over-researched.
Mm. Right.
And it was very useful to me that I had Greg Denning in first year history as an undergrad, and he said that all history writing is the tip of the iceberg. Oh. And all anybody's ever going to see is the tip, but it has to be balanced on that great foundation.
That's a great,
that
yeah.
is underneath. It's a terrific metaphor.
It is, yeah.
Because it always makes you realise that nothing that you are doing in terms of your research is ever wasted because it is foundational to the bit that gets seen. But you also have to decide. I guess that's the hard part. You have to decide what goes above the surface.
Oh, that makes me feel a lot better. Yeah. So I suppose there's that idea of, oh, well, here are the boundaries, but I better go beyond them in case there's something out there that's going to come in.
And so did you know when you started the PhD it was going to be a novel?
By then I did, but I wasn't convinced 30% of it was the exegesis, and that was actually really easy to write. And by then I was also a very fluent nonfiction writer. So even at that point, I was thinking, oh my God, why am I trying to write a novel? Because the 60% that was the novel was terrible. And to this day, like, nobody's allowed to access that. You know, that was thrown out. And what people read in the book now, very little of that was handed in. But the exegesis was bang, came out clean, and that's available online for people to read if they're interested in the factual underpinning.
Oh, that's great to know. And we'll put a link to it on the website if we can. So you had written novels before, but not historical novels. Iris is set in the underbelly of 1930s Sydney. Indelible Ink, which was very formative for me because that's what gave me the permission to get my tattoos at an elderly age.
Mm-hmm.
Indelible Ink was set in the comfortable leafy suburbs of Howard era Sydney.
Mm.
So same city, which is a city you obviously know very well, but different era and a very different cast of characters. Tell us what sort of work was needed to make that turnaround. Was that an archival leap or was that an imaginative leap or a bit of both?
I don't know. I was just thinking, actually, with Indelible Ink, I really got into reading about the art of tattooing. And 20 years ago, that scholarship was beginning to be taken seriously in academic institutions. And I think that, you know, it straddled history, so-called ethnography, although that term's problematic, and art, visual art. And there were two really interesting books. And, of course, this is the best region in the world because it's Asia Pacific and that's where the most ancient extant tattooing traditions are. Indelible Ink, what I'm trying to say is, did have a little bit of archival research in it. It doesn't look like that. But it might have also just been my personal interest in the subject matter that gave me an excuse to read those things. But one of the characters in Indelible Ink is an historian, and he's sort of a Sydney history boffin, and he's struggling with material and wondering how to use it. He's trying to write a PhD, but he doesn't know how it's going to use it. So I think with Iris, you know, this thing about, oh my God, historical novel, I don't read them, I don't write them, how am I going to do it, what am I going to do, is I ended up with four totem books. Wolf Hall, of course, Alias Grace, The Book of Night Women by Marlon James, which not many people have read. They tend to have read his Booker Prize winner, but this is an early book by him and I think it's his best. And it's about a slave rebellion in Jamaica in the 18th century. And it's written in 18th century Jamaican patois, in the voice of a woman. And that was where I thought, this is incredible. Then the fourth book was Billy Bathgate by E.L. Doctorow. And so they were four really different books that you could call historical novels. But interestingly, none of those writers are exclusively historical novelists. And all of those books did different things that were really structural things that were quite amazing. And I don't think I'd ever been great at structure. So I was really looking for books that did good things with structure. And maybe also because of when you're telling historical stories, I don't know, it didn't seem to me that a straightforward chronology would be the way. And the other thing that they do really well, Alias Grace and the Marlon Book of Night Women, is what they do with the voice. So get that voice from the dead to rise up out of the grave and speak, you know, and I wanted to do that. So once I had those books, I thought, okay, I can do this, but I have to figure out how. And a lot of it, the raw material and all of the research was just there. It was really the structure and the plot were the big things.
It is completely incredible, though, the way you don't just recreate the character of Iris, you recreate this whole world of, you know, underworld Sydney in the 1930s. I think I and everyone I know who's read the book, they're really struck by how vivid the language and the scene is. How did you recapture that kind of urban colloquial vernacular?
So I read a lot of early 20th century Australian fiction and the book actually is in conversation with that. There are little ciphers. You know, we're in the hot spot in this studio. It's all happening 5 minutes walk away. So there's a character, for instance, Lick Jimmy is a Chinese grocer who's from a Ruth Park book. There's an incident with a cat being thrown against a wall, which also comes from a Ruth Park book. There's a room in Liverpool Street, which is from Caddy, which is ghostwritten by Dimphna Cusack and Florence James. There are all sorts of things like that. So those books all were set in this area amongst working class people, and they all wrote the vernacular in different ways. There were also court records, depositions, and police reports record the written speech of people, again, in different ways. And there were some kind of obscure nonfiction books that I used to find. You know, once I became interested in this, I'd go trawling through secondhand bookshops, and I found there's a magistrate called Debenham, E.B. Debenham, and he wrote two books about his experience in the courts with criminals. And so there's a really great recording of the voices there. I think it just kind of mashed up in my brain. And Iris's voice came out quite spontaneously in the third or the fourth draft, where I thought, oh, this is just really stilted. There's too much of my 21st century middle classness there. And once her voice came out, I think all that stuff had been just composting. It's my reinvention. Yeah.
Do you have a favourite piece of vernacular, a favourite word?
No, I don't know if I do, actually. No. I don't like all of it, you know.
Yeah.
And I had to trim it down. Another reason I chose to use it is that it's really brutal language. You need to understand how brutal those times were. And so I needed to put it in those words, and just the crudeness and the ruthlessness of it and the bigotry that's just everywhere.
Mm.
I had to pull my punches with a lot of the racism because it's just too much, and it's not, yeah. It's,
oh, that's really too interesting.
It's so difficult. I'm not saying difficult in a whingy way. I just mean, like, because I'm white, I've got a responsibility to witness that and to not whitewash it. But at the same time, I have to rely on 21st century imagination. We do understand a lot more in that space. We have a more nuanced understanding, so not overstate it and not kind of just rehash in a gratuitous way. But whereas I can take full responsibility for all of the stuff, queer, female, sex workery stuff, I'm inside of that.
So. Oh, that's so interesting because, I mean, one of the things that I loved about the language, and, you know, Eve and I have talked about this a lot, was what we both were so grabbed by. It's like, it's almost like the language itself is a character in the way that the weather is a living force in Chekhov or something. And, you know, words like bronzer and rosas.
Yeah, bronzer's pretty good.
Bronzer's great.
Yeah.
I love shivaroo. Yeah, that's my favourite.
Well, shivaroo and rosas are probably Cockney, whereas bronzer is probably Australian.
Sydney Tell us what it means.
So it's an arse, but it's the kind of the whole thing as opposed to just the black dot in the middle of the side of the thing. But Sydney J. Baker's Dictionary of Australian Slang was really useful, and that was a really popular book for literally decades. I think the first one was published in the 1920s, and he kept issuing editions till the 1950s.
I wondered whether there were dictionaries of from the time and whether, you know, we have now every year new words get added to dictionaries and we know that, but at the same time we're less aware of which words drop out.
Yeah.
That's a great archive in itself, isn't it, to go back to that language. But what I'm so curious about in what you're saying is that the language is so vivid that some of the vocab I could only figure out from the context.
Yeah, that's what I needed to do.
Sometimes you just roll with it in the way that you sometimes roll when you're listening to people speak foreign languages, and you can pick out a little word from your high school French or something, but you kind of can get it. But what I felt was that you hadn't cleaned any of it up. But what you're saying is that stuff that you did clean up.
Oh, major. Yeah, I did a major renovation on it. But the thing about putting in words that were not known, again, the Book of Night Women was my guide because I read that book from cover to cover, and when I got to the end of it, there were still a handful of words I didn't know what they were, and I hadn't figured them out, but it didn't prevent me from accessing, you know, the full import of the work. And also the only inroad I had into that book was because of having listened to ska and reggae music. So I had the rhythm of the language already through the music, but I had no other guide because I don't know much about the Caribbean and I haven't read a lot of Caribbean fiction. And yet I got carried along on the music of that language, and usually the words would be explained by context. And so I tried to do that.
You know, you're talking about the voice of Iris, and that once you got her voice, that she was really there for you and present, and it started working in a different way. And I can still hear Iris's voice ringing in my ears. I read the book, you know, months ago now. But she's also a really embodied character. I mean, she's very present. She fills the space in all sorts of ways. And I'm wondering how much being a performance artist enhanced your craft as a writer.
Wow, what a great question. I reckon it probably did. And I think that I've always been a writer who's been engaged with the sensual world. And I've always attributed that to living in Sydney and growing up in a part of the city and living in parts of the city where nature has been really present and dominant, actually. And so I've always responded to the world through all the senses. And I think that's really important. And I think with Iris, the daily grind of poverty is really important. Just what a person has to do to keep warm and get food or just have a decent bed to lie on is so...
Including have sex with people.
Exactly. And yeah. But also having sex in those conditions changes it as well. And having sex in conditions of ignorance and lack of hygiene changes it. And I think that was really important because the other thing about going back to the original museum plaque, the difference between a gangster and a petty thief, is that emphasis on the word petty, this is a tiny, bitsy, a little thing grabbed here and there. Every day you're out, they're trying to get another little thing. There's no Machiavellian plot line and there's no power over other people or power even to something to be attained. It's just the little things. The little things become important. And I think that the performance artist thing is that would have sensitized me to, well, I guess endurance, but also sensation and how that forms character. The other thing about writing in response to the canon of early 20th century Australian fiction is that there is something really wonderfully gritty about these books, and they're written mostly by women. However, there's this huge areas that they just don't go into. Menstruation's never mentioned, or sex and anything queer. And that all comes back to the body. You know, all those things were just absolutely left off the page. And those things are really important to a life, I think. Mm. Yeah.
in writing those queer themes of the book and embodied themes, because it is a very queer book, as we've said, you know, Iris is a woman who loves women, but there's also, you know, she's part of a broader queer kind of subculture. How much of that is your imagination versus, you know, how much of it is researched, and where did you find this kind of underworld marginalised history?
Yeah, so it's my imagination, but there's a million and one signposts in the book that are from the public record, and a significant place is Blackadders, which was up the road in Wentworth Avenue, and Gary Wotherspoon writes about that in City of the Plain, and in turn he got information about it from some oral histories that were published in Campaign magazine in the 1980s, and these old guys were interviewed who'd been around in the 30s and 40s, and they'd gone to this place. It would have been a studio above a car showroom, and Wentworth Avenue is one of the only streets in Sydney that is similar now to what it was then. So on the top floor, it would have just been plain studios. And so this guy, whose name was Roy Pierce or Ray Sales, everybody had a few aliases then, used to run dancing classes there during the day, and then at night, when the sale of alcohol was illegal, it turned into a dancing club called the Avenue Club, or colloquially known as Blackadders. And so he clearly was, you know, someone who cross-dressed and was what they called a coloured man, or, well, we could just call him a Black Australian. And I have researched him, and his ethnicity is not clear. There's a photograph of his brother in one of Peter Doyle's books when he's gone by the name of Henry Pierce, and Henry Pierce was a convicted cocaine dealer in the 1920s. And in the births of this family, there are nine children, and they are listed as biological brothers, and they were born in Grafton. And there's a third brother whose name is Ranji, an Indian name, and the father claimed he was Portuguese, he worked in Lismore. And all of these things point to a way in which Indigenous people had to hide their ethnicity at the time when their kids would have been taken away, or they couldn't get a job, or just even hold a family together. That person and that place definitely existed. I've imposed a little posse of queer women into the club, which is just as it's been for us since the 1980s. And so I feel kind of comfortable with that truth. I think that's probably how it would have been. And sex workers, that sort of community still exists now in the parties that I go to. It's that kind of mixture of people. There are usually more men than women. There are a hell of a lot more trans people now, of course, you know, the great transgender revolution of the last 20 years. But essentially, it is predominantly cis male space, sex workers, queer women, trans people. I think that the percentages are probably getting more balanced now, which is good.
I actually want to pick up on that reference to the parties you go to, because I'm really interested in how the fact that you've lived in Sydney for seems like your whole life and existed in these kind of queer subcultures and lived in Surry Hills at one point, I believe, how that kind of deep knowledge of a queer Sydney informed the writing of this book.
Yeah, it would have in exactly the instance of that club and how I created the world of that club. But there are also two books which were memoirs, one written by Jack Lindsay and the other one by John Rose, and they go into early 20th century bohemian life in Sydney. And both those writers left Sydney to live in London, where they could be gay more easily, and published these memoirs in the 1950s or 60s. And they recount these famous arts balls in the 1920s, and there were also places in King's Cross. Later on, the action moved up to the Cross in sort of the 40s. And again, there's several characters who are Black Australians, clearly, or so-called coloured men, who are running clubs. They're in about three different instances. Fantastic cross-dressers, amazing outfits, personalities that are towering over the proceedings and clearly hosting and running the joint. And I was informed by those accounts as well. There's something a little bit hyperbolic about them. I don't read them entirely as memoir. They're a little bit fictional. But there's clearly a community and key players in that community that come through. And layering over my experience of Sydney as a queer person, I found a sort of a community or goings-on that I felt comfortable with. And I also felt comfortable interposing Iris into that because she was a busker. So she was a musician. And she took herself seriously as a musician. She got quite obstreperous in later on in the 40s when she was defending herself, which she did in the courtroom, because she was being arrested and imprisoned for busking, and she'd say, I'm a musician. I am earning my living by playing music in the streets. I just thought, of course she'd want to be going dancing, and of course she'd be quite comfortable hanging around with the renegades and the fringe dwellers, because she was one.
Which is the license that you have in a novel that you wouldn't have had in a non-fiction book, where because you didn't have the evidence to say that that's what she was doing, that is where the leeway comes in.
Yeah.
We're going to have to start wrapping up, unfortunately, because I'm loving where this conversation is going. But the other thing that I totally adored about Iris, and we've said it's a very embodied book and it's a very languaged book, but there's also a very visceral sense of place. And I'll never walk down the streets of Surrey Hills again and look at them in the same way again. In fact, coming up in the taxi this morning from the airport, we just passed the old hat factory that has been destroyed by fire, which I've been following in the news.
Yeah.
And it made me immediately wonder, in fact, when I heard about it on the news earlier this week, even though, as I said, I haven't read Iris for months, it made me immediately wonder what that might have been used for and who would have inhabited that space. And my misery at that building having been destroyed by the fire is that all of that history is lost to it. You know, your pages just sort of pulsate with this life that makes you see the streets today in a different way. And I'm wondering whether Iris is in its own way a kind of an historical travel memoir, as foreign or as strange as Poland.
Yeah. It kind of is in Sydney, because we have destroyed so much in this city, and that's why it's really tragic, that building going up in flames. I might have been motivated by that, like, to record this. I do want it to have documentary validity, and I was very careful with the archive to make sure I didn't change anything. I've been interviewed by one historian, well, you're the next, and I do want to be in conversation with historians, like, on the level. Also because I feel indebted. And so historiographically, yes, it is absolutely authentic and true to how things were, what was on what street, what people could wear, what women could do, what they were eating. It's definitely a record in that sense, yeah.
I think you've done us all a great service, Fiona.
Oh, thank you, thank
us
you.
Us historians, us readers, us literary and historical community, and just everybody who loves a good read, because it is a truly marvellous novel and it plays out in my mind.
The book ends in 1937. Can you give us any peek of what happens to Iris after that?
Sure. The period immediately following 1937, she gets really jumped on by the cops. Like, every time she goes out to busk, she's arrested, and it's a constant thing. For about 3 years, and she's still living in Clisdell Street. And then she goes away, probably at the beginning of the war. I don't know where she goes. Maybe she goes back to Glen Innes. When she came back, she was arrested and imprisoned for assault and robbery. And the trial for that went on for over a year. And essentially she spent nearly 12 months on remand, clearly being punished not for those crimes that she's accused of committing, but for the past infractions that the police didn't get her for. That's my interpretation. When she finally got out of prison in 1942 or 3, she went down to Woolloomooloo and she conducted a sly grog business. And she lived there until the 1950s, when she went to Pelican Street in Surrey Hills, where she died in 1953 of metastasized rectal cancer and diabetes. Only 47 years old, and a death of poverty and a hard life. Woolloomooloo is the next area where I'll go to when I write about her.
And you're planning to write about her again?
Yeah, but she's kind of receding, so I don't really know what I'll do with it yet, but there'll be a little bit of that.
Okay, and I can't let you go without asking, is Iris going to live on screen? Because obviously Underbelly, Razor Gang featured Tilly Devine and Kate Lee, but this novel just jumps off the page and demands to be rendered on screen.
I wish. No bites. I think it'd be a good TV series, but nothing yet. So if anyone's out there and wants to option it, just, get your people to call my people.
And we'll put all of Fiona's details on the website so they can find your people. Sadly, that's all we have time for today. Thanks so much for joining us today, Fiona. It's been a real treat to have you with us.
Thanks for having me. It's been an absolute pleasure.
To learn more about Fiona's work, you can check out her website, fionakmcgregor.com, or follow her on Instagram at Fiona Kelly McGregor.
And you can follow Eve on Instagram at Eve Rees.
You can follow Claire on Twitter at Claire A. Wright or on Instagram at Claire Wright Historian. And don't forget, you can catch up on all of seasons 1, 2, 3 and 4 via the website archivefeverpod.com.
So until our next therapeutic session, I'm Claire Wright.
And I'm Eve Rees.
And you've been listening to Archive Fever, a La Trobe University podcast recorded today at King Studios on unceded Gadigal land and produced by Matt Smith on unceded Wurundjeri and Bunurong land.
Our theme music is by Poddington Bear. You can hear more at soundofpicture.com.
Coming up on the next episode.
I think looking at national history through foreign archives really allows for less navel gazing. Mm. It allows us to sidestep the main stories like Anzac and to contextualize them in a different way. And I think that for a multicultural society, there's no better way to try to understand who we are and where we come from, rather than just assuming that the past was monolingual, because it wasn't. So I think that looking at Australian history from foreign sources really has the power to de-dramatise Australian history, to give it less importance, in a sense.